He has been nominated to be House Speaker.
Fairly new member of Congress, a far-right member of the Freedom Caucus. And like you said, the Republicans were extremely proud to eventually move their support to him. They started with a number of others, like Jim Jordan and others. One of the Republicans, when they got up, basically gave a speech about Frederick Douglass, reminding the Democrats that Frederick Douglass was a Republican and how Douglass said he would always and only ever be a Republican. And then from there, nominated, Byron. So it's kind of a play that they're making on identity politics.
And of course, we'll continue to cover this. Ryan Grimm, D.C. Bureau for The Intercept, and Democratic Congressmember-elect Greg Kassar of Texas. Happy birthday to Clary Ibarra, and belated happy birthday to Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman with NERMI.
What do we mean when we talk about personality? What is your personality?
Tuned in to listener-supported community radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the EPA says no more polluting the Columbia River dams in Oregon and Washington. Too many pets to handle, overwhelming Multnomah County's animal shelter. And promise to keep the door open to ideas and to people from Multnomah County's newly elected leader.
We have a chance to reset relationships between cities and county, and I intend to do just that.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 5th, 2023. I am Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. With a vow to collaborate and keep her door open to people and ideas, Jessica Vega Peterson was sworn in Tuesday evening as the new Multnomah County Chair. She is the 13th chair to serve since the current form of home rule government was established in 1966. She gave this speech, talking to her supporters and staff after she was sworn in, focusing on the challenges ahead.
To tackle our biggest challenges, with so many issues to prioritize right now, our biggest leadership opportunity is in how we work together. We have a chance to reset relationships between cities and the county and between state and the county, and I intend to do just that. I will be a Multnomah County Chair whose door is open, who works collaboratively, not just with my fellow commissioners, two of whom are here today. Thank you so much, Commissioner Jayapal and Commissioner Stegman. Oh, and Commissioner Rosenbaum, newly appointed. But also with the many others leaders whose work touches ours, whose work complements and amplifies the work that we do at the county. We'll be a chair ready to listen, to ask questions, and to use collaborative decision-making to set priorities that will move us all forward. And this moment provides us with huge opportunities to set a big table and to invite everyone to surround it with us. A practice that has already begun at Multnomah County, and one that I committed to following through on and expanding. Because if we are going to create the systems that don't break people's spirits, we need to be sure that those people are involved in what we're creating. And I've done this as I've solved biz problems in the past. Problems like how to provide universal preschool to every child in Multnomah County, or how to collaboratively site shelters in neighborhoods. I want to make sure that the tables we set are filled with people our policies will most impact and whose lives those policies have the most chance to transform. As a Latina, as a mother, as a proud resident of East Portland, I have experienced bias and discrimination. Of course, I have had challenges that I've overcome. We all have those. One of the wisest guidance I know for life reflects that. Treat others always with kindness, because everyone you meet is fighting a battle. This has proven true over and over again for me, and the people I've met with seem to have everything together, who are so accomplished, but who are also carrying the burdens of illness, abuse, or loss. A few weeks ago, when we were working to use unexpected funds outside our normal budget to invest $16.2 million to target housing and houselessness, decisions designed to prevent an estimated 3,400 individuals and families from becoming housed, we spent hours hearing testimony from those community members most impacted. There were many important takeaways that day, including one of our houseless neighbors who said, "I am not camping when I am out there. Camping, you leave on Friday, you come back Sunday. I'm out there surviving. That is not camping, that is living." I think people need to be dealt with on the human level, on the heart level. That is what I believe too. People should be seen and heard on the human level, on the heart level. As we move forward in this work together, I will continue to prioritize ways of working together that brings us closer to that opportunity and that reality. I want to thank you all for being here tonight. Also have to make sure that I thank my incredible team who was a big part of making this whole evening happen. First of all, thank you to the Multnomah County Library in Bailey for hosting tonight. This is just really incredible. It was important to me that we use this beautiful county space in the heart of downtown Portland because this is where we are at. This is the heart of work that we do, and I'm so proud to be here. I also want to thank the team that has been with me for the last several years, Chris and Hayden and Olivia. Yay! I also want to thank and introduce the folks who will be joining my team either already or in the next couple weeks. Sarah, Stacy, Lakeitha, and Lynn. I'm so excited to have you. And of course, I have to thank my family. They're such an important part of my life. I want to thank my sister Natalie, her husband Aaron, my niece and nephew Vega, or Scout and Jude, who are here tonight, who came down from Seattle just to be here tonight, who missed a half day of school just to be here, which I'm sure was tough. My father and my mother, thank you so much for everything that you have done. You are really the reason that I do this, and I know that my sisters do. We do as well. I want to thank my other sister, Lauren, Zachary, and Vega, who are here, and Aunt Claudia, who is here, such a huge part of the family. And then I have to thank, because like, I literally always forget to thank them, my daughter, Deborah, my son, Xander, and my husband, Aaron, who is so amazing. Who allows me to do, not allows, but you know, like enables me to do this, the work that I do. And I also want to thank the incredible people from Multnomah County. I know many of you are here tonight. I am so excited and proud to work with all of you, and especially, as I mentioned before, my board members and the commissioners that are here. I want to thank everyone who is in this room. As I said at the beginning, you are here because you believe in our county. You believe in what we are able to do together. You're willing to put your time, energy, and life into making this a better place. And that is the work that we have in front of us, but is work I am so excited to do in partnership with all of you. I believe in this opportunity before of us. I'm excited for the next 4 years. And so thank you again, and let's get to work.
And that was Jessica Vega Peterson, the newly elected Multnomah County Chair. Meantime, lost pets and other stray animals are overwhelming Multnomah County's animal shelter. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on that story.
Multnomah County has stopped taking in stray animals. Animal Services says overcrowding and low staffing have overwhelmed the shelter. The agency is hopeful a week-long halt will help keep the shelter from becoming overburdened and will prevent the need to euthanize animals related to capacity. Animal Services has not had to put animals down in recent years. The unprecedented situation was exacerbated by a surge in lost and stray pets over the holidays when fireworks caused scared animals to run away from their homes. The shelter had only 5 openings as of yesterday. A lack of shelter capacity is actually a nationwide problem. While Multnomah County will still call upon community partners to help handle overflow, other shelters are also having trouble with capacity issues. Adoptions moved online during the COVID-19 pandemic and have remained virtual ever since. However, the agency hopes to resume in-person adoptions on January 11th. Animal Services did not open the shelter to the public earlier because there were insufficient staff available to manage in-person adoptions. The shelter says adopting and fostering animals is the best way to help. In addition, Multnomah County Animal Services staff are asking anyone who already volunteers with any animal welfare organization to consider volunteering at the shelter. The county will continue to help deal with strays, especially dangerous animals that pose a risk to public safety. However, most strays are found within a small area around their actual home. The shelter encourages community members who find strays to try and find the animal owner. People who find a pet are advised to check for a Multnomah County license tag. They can look online to view animals reported lost by their owner and can submit a found report. People can search for owners on community pages such as Craigslist and Nextdoor. Lost animals can also be scanned for a microchip at a veterinarian's office. Steps must be taken to legally keep a found animal as a pet. These are outlined in a Multnomah County ordinance. For KBOO News, Josh Salem.
The Columbia River is known for its salmon and steelhead runs. In a year of good returns, more than 1 million of the fish travel up the river to spawn. The Environmental Protection Agency has ordered the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to stop discharging oil and other pollutants into the Columbia from four dams in Oregon and Washington. As Mark Moran reports, this came after the group Columbia Riverkeeper said toxic chemicals harm fish and other wildlife in the Columbia and Snake Rivers. It sued the Corps last year.
The EPA has ordered the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to stop oil and other toxic chemical discharges into the Columbia River in Washington and Oregon. Recent spills have the issue back at the forefront. The group Columbia Riverkeeper sued the Corps last year and says these pollutants harm fish and other wildlife in the Columbia and Snake Rivers. Miles Johnson, the group's senior attorney, says the permits address four dams along the river that are pollution sources, and the problem is bigger than petroleum and chemical pollution.
In addition, the dams create big reservoirs that suck up the sun's energy and make the river too hot for salmon and steelhead. The permits that EPA issued to the Army Corps are a directive to deal with some of those problems.
In operating the dams, the Corps will be required to use environmentally friendly lubricants, pay closer attention to water temperatures in the reservoirs, and remove water from some of them if they get too hot for the fish to survive. The issue was highlighted again recently when between 300 and 600 gallons of oil leaked into the Snake River from a turbine at Little Goose Dam in East Washington. Johnson says this type of pollution has become a pattern with the Corps and has to be monitored and addressed constantly.
Sometimes it's 1 gallon, sometimes it's 5 gallons, sometimes it's hundreds of gallons or even thousands of gallons. Sometimes that oil contains toxic chemicals like PCBs, and after watching it happen over and over again, Columbia Riverkeeper took action, which is what we do when someone illegally discharges pollution into the river.
The EPA took the action under the Clean Water Act. Columbia Riverkeeper has sued federal and state agencies multiple times and continues to monitor Northwest waterways and the wildlife that depend on them. For Oregon News Service, I'm Mark Moran.
Plastic packaging is especially prevalent and hard to recycle. Many Washingtonians have seen their recycling costs increase in the past few years. As Eric Tegedoff reports, now state lawmakers in Washington are introducing a bill designed to cut down on packaging and improve recycling in the state.
A bill in Olympia aims to reduce packaging and improve recycling in Washington state. The Washington Recycling and Packaging RAP Act is designed to cut down on unnecessary packaging, which often is plastic used only once and hard to recycle. One part of the legislation will create a producer responsibility system, which requires companies to be responsible for packaging at the end of its life. Mazzy Nowicki is a University of Washington student and the Beyond Plastics coordinator for WashPerg students.
Recycling in general is really expensive and ends up as a burden on consumers, local governments, taxpayers, whereas that cost should be put on producers instead.
Residents in 11 Washington state counties don't have access to recycling. More than half of Washington's consumer paper and packaging ends up in landfills and incinerators, according to an analyst with Seattle Public Utilities. Plastic producers and recyclers say the policy will not be useful if it creates too many onerous regulations on industries. The legislation was unveiled at an event at the Seattle Aquarium on Wednesday and will be championed in the Senate by Bainbridge Island Democrat Christine Rolfes and the House by Seattle Democrat Liz Berry. Nora Nickum with the Seattle Aquarium says under the RAP Act, packaging producers would pay into a program that would go towards recycling infrastructure.
But they would pay less into the system if what they are making is more sustainable. And so that would be a built-in incentive to redesign things in a way that's more environmentally friendly.
In 2017, Washington state residents and businesses produced about 410,000 tons of plastic packaging waste, and only about 17% of waste was collected for recycling. Nickum says that plastic is harmful for the environment and wildlife, especially as it breaks down into microplastics.
Dealing with the problem of waste in the environment is much easier to address at the source before it gets to the environment in the first place, because it is so hard to clean up once it's there.
Similar producer responsibility legislation has been passed in other states, including California and Oregon. The RAP Act also will establish a bottle deposit program. The legislative session begins on Monday. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 8, Ear to the Streets of Flint. Tonight's weather, rain showers this evening, clearing overnight, down to a low 41. Tomorrow, we'll see rain showers in the morning, evolving to steady rain in the afternoon, reaching a high of 51. For today in history, we have a special local feature. The Oregon Historical Society is presenting a free event next Tuesday night as part of a series that raises funds and enhances education for local students and teachers. I talked to its presenter, historian and author, Dr. Chris Gulls.
It's in the series, the Historians in the News series, really exciting. So we're well into a third year of this. It started in the pandemic. This one is with a renowned historian from the University of Texas, Jeremy Suri, who has a really exciting, great book out now. We'll be talking about democracy, about elections, about sort of the history that underlies the current challenges for the U.S. in this moment. And in particular, and with reference to his recent book, Civil War by Another Means. We'll be talking about kind of the long ramifications or reverberations of the Civil War, how there are echoes of Civil War still with us today.
I have talked to him about his book. So you've actually worked with him on your ideology book.
I did indeed. Yes. Yeah. And so he wrote a chapter in the ideology book on types of freedom and ideology in U.S. foreign relations. Really good chapter. And then was part of several of our panels about the book, the Society for Historians of American Foreign Relations annual conference, several of the others, including one out of UT Austin. He's a fantastic scholar, written a whole lot of books. He's written on the American presidency. He's got a good book on that called The Impossible Presidency, written about nation building in the U.S., written on Henry Kissinger. So we'll have a really wide-ranging conversation. The idea of the series is that we bring together a top historian and me and some of the OHS staff, the great staff, roughly 3 or 4 months, so 3 or 4 times a year, to talk really about how there's a deep context for what's going on in the present moment. So what's the history behind, say, ripping a line from the headlines? And then secondarily, about what it means to do public history in some ways. What are the kinds of challenges that we have in the present? What are the impulses for professional historians to address the current moment using their expertise? What are the ways that institutions of public history, cultural institutions in general, can be part of that project, bringing the best historical humanities insights to wider audiences in a nonpartisan or apolitical sort of way, such as Oregon Historical Society or museums. The whole idea is to have this kind of scholarly analysis that's accessible about current news stories in some ways, but also about just deeper and broader histories. And one of the things we really like about the series is it's a conversation. So it'll be a conversation with me and with Jeremy Suri, and it'll be started by the chief of all programs there and the editor of the Oregon Historical Quarterly, Eliza Canty Jones, and then with the audience. So you can throw Q&A in the chat. You know, we really wish we could do it in person and have a very lively conversation. But actually, we found the advantages starting the pandemic of doing this by Zoom is that we get worldwide audiences. So we can't all be together, but we can have much bigger, more wide-ranging kinds of audiences and conversations. But this is actually just a program of the Oregon Historical Society. And it began as a fundraiser in the early pandemic, asking for donations and bringing in these historians pro bono to help raise funds so that there wouldn't have to be furloughs or even firings at the Historical Society. And that those moments, and now it seems like a long period of time, but also somewhat past, where we couldn't get together, where people couldn't go into this physical building, and we didn't yet know about the PPE and other kinds of programs that would help add funds to save cultural institutions. So it began as a fundraiser, and it's now just taken off. We've got a great group of people who come every session, we've got people who donate as well. We do ask for donations if you're interested and able to support the OHS's mission, but it is free and public.
And our job's still on the line right now?
The OHS is doing better. It's really quite stable now, as I understand it. I've cycled off the board. So full disclosure, I used to be a member of the Board of Trustees, but not anymore. So they're doing well. But of course, the kind of public mission of the OHS could really use that support. And so I think one of the things that was great about the OHS in those first early days of the pandemic and continues today is it had already developed a robust online and set of digital offerings, resources for teachers, resources for students, and for a much wider public. So they've got these e-digests that come out every week. They've got things targeted to teachers and students. They've got all kinds of programs for better publics in Portland, across Oregon, Pacific Northwest, and across the U.S. And so all that costs money. I mean, you know, it should be obvious to anyone listening. So part of not necessarily needing more funds per se, not out of desperation, but for building these kinds of really robust offerings that are state and nationwide that really could use the support. And of course, you know, I think another element of this is it really helps to be able to say that there are lots of individual donors. It doesn't necessarily matter how much people are giving. And so it helps some nonprofits to have a wider total donor base and more interaction as well. So sometimes I think this too, I'm resentful of giving my email information or other information when I go to these sorts of events and things, but actually being a subscriber, joining either public and free events, right? This is part of supporting an institution. It isn't just about donations per se. If you can give a small amount, that would be great. If you could provide some feedback on the events, that would also be excellent. There are lots of ways to make a difference engaging with nonprofits and cultural institutions.
They invited me to the celebration they had. It was very nice for the 124th year of OHS. Mm-hmm. And they talked about the next 125 years, what they're going to do. And one of the things that was really interesting that they're going to try to roll out this year is a new exhibit about Portland's history. And they're going to try to incorporate it into the third grade curriculum for local kids.
That's so exciting. Yeah. You know, one of the things I've heard a lot and heard as a member of the board is people coming through loving the new Oregon My Oregon, now Experience Oregon, exhibit, a whole new way of telling the state's history. People often said, okay, now where's the Portland version, right? Mm-hmm. And Portland is built into that story, of course, but people wanted a Portland-specific one. And I think that's going to help drive attendance. It'll be great for students. Frankly, I'm ready to go check it out and see what they put together. So yes, I think that'll be a really good resource for the Historical Society and for Portlanders, tourists, Oregonians in general.
Yeah, because they said they actually had people coming from out of town wanting to learn more about Portland, and the resources just weren't there, or the exhibit wasn't there. So they're going to be catering specifically to that, but also teach the next generation about the local history.
Yeah, and I think the 125th is a really important moment. You know, anniversaries sometimes sound hokey for celebrating, or it can seem like they're a PR stunt to get attention. But actually, I think they're a nice moment to pause and to reflect on that history. How did the OHS develop in the late 19th century? What were its origins and what was the meaning of developing a historical society then? How has that changed over time? And then, you know, looking forward, what is the best kind of path to chart moving forward? What would we want to see in 10, 20, 50 years? And then try for some ambitious, you know, 100-year time horizon sort of grand strategy. They're very important. And I know that there are some really exciting new programs that are being developed as part of the 125th that will be looking for funds, but also looking to roll out some fascinating new history for wider publics and new kinds of programs that the OHS can really plant its flag and declare and show just how fantastic of a historical society it is. Just one more point there. You know, as a professional historian, I've probably been to the majority of major historical societies in the U.S. And, you know, Oregon is very lucky to have the OHS. It's one of the best in the U.S. I think it's a little known or relatively little known gem, although it's won a lot of awards. So, you know, in the community of historical societies and public history museums, it is well known, but to wider audiences, not as much. And so hopefully things like the 125th can be a kind of rallying point and cause to showcase just how great this cultural institution is. It's supported by a levy and by Multnomah County. That doesn't always happen. That's a big part of the success, that it partners with the community there in Portland and across the state very closely. Not all historical societies do that, working across communities, in fact. So that's really impressive and significant. And a lot of other historical societies, frankly, are run out of the state legislature, the governor's office. Their boards are appointed by those figures. So they have an inherent politics that gets in the way of the mission. And that does not happen, in my experience with the OHS, which is another real selling point for that place.
And that was historian and author Dr. Chris Nichols. After 9 ballots, a Speaker of the House still has not been elected, and frustration is growing. Democrats promote their 2023 agenda, and the U.S. develops a strategy to boost women's economic participation. For more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2023 Talks.
The tellers agree in their tallies that the total number of votes cast is 433, of which the Honorable Hakeem Jeffries of the state of New York has received 212.
The House of Representatives is still without a speaker, as none of the people nominated have met the requisite 218-vote threshold to secure the position. In the sixth ballot, Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries led the pack with 212 votes, while House Leader Kevin McCarthy had only 201 votes. 20 votes have consistently voted for Florida Representative Byron Donalds in several ballots. During the fourth ballot, Indiana Representative Victoria Spartz voted present rather than for McCarthy, as she'd done in the prior three ballots. President Joe Biden said, having a Congress unable to function is embarrassing. Representative Lauren Boebert called on former President Donald Trump to encourage McCarthy to step aside and let someone else have a chance at becoming Speaker of the House. Meanwhile, House Democratic Caucus Chair Pete Aguilar is grateful to see Democrats unified behind their candidate Speaker of the House and the issues they plan to tackle in the coming year.
House Democrats are unified. You saw that yesterday. We're unified behind lowering costs, creating good-paying jobs, and building safer communities. The contrast between House Democrats, the chaos and confusion taking place on the other side of the aisle could not be more clear.
He added House Democrats are more than willing to work with reasonable Republicans. Ted Lieu, vice chair of the House Democratic Caucus, said having one branch of the federal government in dysfunction cannot continue. Lieu added, if Republicans can't come together to govern, they should step aside to allow Democrats to do so. House Republican veterans are angered with the infighting. The former service members are eager to ensure veterans are able to lead the Veterans Affairs Committee, conduct oversight of the recently passed PACT Act, and hold hearings on the mental health impacts of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. Representative Matt Waltz described what needs to happen in Congress.
I think my colleagues would join me in that this is unacceptable. Some points have been made, concessions have been made, and now is time to move on, to move forward, and to govern as the way the American people elect us to do.
The State Department has launched the first U.S. strategy on global women's economic security. Secretary of State Antony Blinken explained it is designed to break the barriers women face in economic participation.
The strategy that we're putting forward has at its heart a simple vision, creating a world in which all men and girls everywhere can contribute to and benefit from economic growth and global prosperity.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
The Biden administration has implemented All In this year. This is a new program aimed at reducing homelessness in America 25% by the year 2025. Roz Brown reports.
Volunteers will be fanning out across New Mexico cities this month for the point in time count, even as a new program launches nationwide to reduce homelessness. The Biden administration's All In program aims to reduce homelessness in the U.S. at least 5% by 2025. The Department of Housing and Urban Development's 2022 report found that more than 582,000 people were experiencing homelessness on a single night in January last year. Senior advisor Richard Cho says homelessness among certain subpopulations decreased in 2022, including 11% for veterans.
But homelessness also rose for single individuals. Those are adults who are not part of a family or who don't have children with them. And it rose even higher for individuals who have disabilities who are long-term homeless, people who are chronically homeless. It was actually 15%.
The federally required point-in-time counts began in 2005. Document on a single winter night, typically in January, the number of people in a community are unhoused. The report shows that in 2022, rural areas saw the biggest graphic increase of homelessness at 6%. Jeff Olivet with the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness is confident the federal government's all-in strategic plan will offer a roadmap for people getting into housing along with an income that allows them to thrive.
In a country where roughly the same number of people become homeless and escape homelessness on a daily basis, all-in aims to prevent homelessness before it happens.
Chu noted the dramatic increase in rental costs across many parts of the U.S. He says federal and state emergency rental assistance during the pandemic allowed more than 12 million people to pay their rent and avoid evictions, but adds that progress cannot continue without more permanent supportive housing.
The decreases that we saw in chronic homelessness from 2010 to 2016, since 2016, the pace of new permanent supportive housing creation has slowed significantly.
This is Roz Brown.
You're listening to an end-of-year fun drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for January 5th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Gillum, Eric Tegadoff, Mark Moran, and Roz Brown. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Dr. Chris Nichols. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell, so glad to have you with us. All of our KBOO programs, including the Eve News, are supported by our members. So if you'd like to become a member and support our program, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, coming up next.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. The U.S. Defense Department has once again failed to pass a basic audit. But despite the Pentagon's failure to show it knows where its money is going, Congress appears ready to add tens of billions of additional dollars to the department's already huge budget.